Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. Welcome, everyone, to Value Investing Live. I'm pleased to welcome our guest, David Marcus, co-founder, CEO, and Chief Investment Officer of Evermore Global Advisors. He co-founded the firm in 2009 and is the portfolio manager of the Evermore Global Value Fund and their separate account portfolios. As always, for those of you out in the audience, do please feel free to post your questions and comments in the chat section throughout the presentation, but do keep in mind we are going to hold those until the Q&A section at the end. Without anything further from me, I'm going to go ahead and hand things over to David so we can jump into the presentation today.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Graham. And thanks for inviting me to be part of this. So I guess what I'll do over the next hour is I'll break it into three sections. The first section will be sort of who am I, my background, how I invest, how we look at things globally, our process. Then I'll get into some specific investments, why we like them, what we think the opportunity is, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. So my firm, Evermore Global Advisors, I started about 12 years ago. We are a special situations investor, meaning we're looking for companies that are not just high growth or value or anything of that nature. They have to have something, I'll say, quirky going on. It could be it's cheap and there's catalysts. So at the core, we are value investors, but we start by asking simple questions like, why is this stock cheap? What's going to make it go up? How do we get there? We don't just want to buy cheap, what we think are cheap stocks, and hope that the market will balance out over time. A lot of people talk about value investing. It's dead. It's changing. It's coming back. It's forever going to come back. It's going to revert to the mean. The reality is it might. We don't know if it will. But we don't want to outsource our thinking to the market's perception of it coming back. And that's why we focus on catalysts. That's why we really want to say, okay, that's a 50-cent dollar. Now, these are the catalysts to make that value get to us as shareholders. So we focus on breakups, spinoffs, restructurings. We have an affinity for family-controlled businesses where they've been long-term owners of a business, maybe multi-generational, and they have just made very smart decisions in the long run that have created a lot of value for shareholders. So we have we're not a hedge fund. We have a mutual fund, and we do managed accounts for some college endowments and family offices on the managed accounts. The mutual fund, traditional mutual fund, and we're on, I think, 60 different platforms. And we really had the idea to bring everything that we ever learned in our careers into a mutual fund format when we put the business together 12 years ago. So my couple of minutes on who am I? I was very lucky that I started right out of college. I went to Northeastern in Boston, where they had a co-op program. So you get to work 6 months full-time, three times by the time you graduate. It's a five-year undergrad program. And I was lucky that I got to work for Michael Price, who's really considered one of the great value investors. His firm Mutual Series is today called Franklin Mutual. It's part of Franklin Templeton. I started there as an intern. I answered the phones during the crash, before, during, and after the crash of 1987. Starting during a crisis is really one of the great times that you can start in a business because you just see how people act and react during that period. And I got to watch him and his team buying the day before the crash, buying the day of the crash, and buying the day after, and just see how they didn't panic. They took advantage of opportunities. So I worked there for 13 years. I went from answering the phones as an intern, working my way up to a junior trader on the trading desk, senior trader, junior analyst, just kept working my way up. He really ran the firm as a meritocracy. You were there to make money for the clients. And if he saw that there was something in you that could help get to that, you had a shot to keep moving forward. In 2000, I decided to move on and do my own thing. But along the way, I actually discovered that there was a country called Sweden. And as a firm, we had never invested there. And what I found in the early 1990s was that they were going through a banking crisis in Sweden, devastating crisis. The government was bailing out companies. It was a real problem. Today, many of those banks are some of the strongest in the world. So the lessons I learned way back then, 30 years ago, was you take advantage of a crisis. Crisis brings investment opportunities. But also in a crisis, investors go home. So I went to Sweden during the crisis. I had the place to myself because all foreign investors had pretty much, the Brits went back to the UK, the Americans to the US, Germans to Germany. I had the whole place to myself. I just kept coming back over and over and over. And I started doing that when I was about 26. I had literally never been outside the United States before that point in time. So that was the first place that I ever went. I got a passport. I went to Sweden. But what I saw early on was that there were families that controlled companies. The Wallenberg family controlled Astra. Today, that's AstraZeneca, Ericsson, Electrolux, Saab, all kinds of things that they controlled. Other families, the guys who built H&M, were building that up. And I realized you have to understand what the main shareholder thinks, because they could fire the CEO or the chairman tomorrow. You have to have a sense for what they're focusing on and their tone. Do they think about the shareholders? Do they not think about the shareholders? Do they take advantage of the shareholders? So understanding what the main shareholder is thinking, I think, is critically important. So after I did that in Sweden, I worked my way around the Nordic region, and then I did it in the rest of Europe, France, Germany, UK, calling on all these families to get to know how they were thinking about value creation, if they were thinking about it at all, and really building a network of extensive families, investment banks, all kinds of groups to really help us get depth of knowledge in these markets. So in 2000, when I decided to quit and do my own thing, I called all these families that I had stakes in their companies and the portfolios that I was managing. And one of them, a Swedish billionaire industrialist, said, you know, I'd like to be partners with you. And so he invited me to spend time with him on his boat in the Bahamas. By the end of that weekend, I had a huge $100 million commitment from him. Back then, in 2000, his U.S. headquarters was the top floor of the Citicorp building in New York. Gave me all, I hadn't even quit my job yet. So I had this commitment from him to start. And I thought, man, I made it. This titan of European business wants to partner with me to invest in Europe. And so we kicked that off in 2000. But sadly, 2 years into our partnership, what happened? He died. Now, he was the chairman of seven public companies in Europe. So at that point, his daughter inherited control of seven public companies. She had just started working for me as a junior analyst. So if you could imagine, my junior analyst now became my biggest investor. She asked me to help her. I closed the business and I helped them build a family office from scratch. I went on boards of some of their companies and helped them restructure businesses. So the point of telling this part of my backstory is that you get lessons on every single thing that you do. I didn't start by thinking about having operating experience. You just take advantage of opportunities as they come along by going on boards, helping restructure companies, making decisions that were critical, where we were changing boards and changing management teams in some cases throughout Europe. You get just another depth of knowledge and understanding for how to look at companies. So that even today, all these years later, some companies pitching what they're going to do in terms of restructuring, we might say, oh, they're sandbagging it. They should be able to do it faster than that. Or you might think the other. There's no way they can do it that fast. So you just want to be a sponge, learning and as much as you can on all of these things. So in any case, once I felt that they were in good shape, I said, okay, I'm going to start my own business. Again, I wanted to get back to what I love, which is stock picking. And I started a fund where we would take big stakes in small companies in Europe, a private equity approach to public companies. The idea was small and mid-sized companies that were good businesses, but they stumbled. We would take a fair amount of a stake. We would take a board seat or two and help them get back on track. We found that a lot of small and mid-sized public companies were extremely good at their business, but they were not the best at capital markets. When they were doing an offering to raise capital, should they use this firm or that firm, how they should structure deals, So we brought a lot of that to them. And just as they were transforming their businesses into higher growth businesses. I ran that from 04 to 08. And then ultimately kind of that was the genesis. We kind of wrapped that business up during the financial crisis. My partner was a private equity group. They wanted to go into a different direction. And we decided to create Evermore Global. And as I said earlier, build a business where we could take advantage of everything we ever learned, public equity, private equity, venture cap, restructuring, this real operating experience, and this extensive network of bankers that we had developed over the years. It wasn't about get to know the biggest bulge bracket firms. It was who's the best banker in Germany, or who's the best in salmon farming, who's the best in whatever vertical we were looking at or specific sector, and really getting in with them so that we were in the deal flow for opportunities that we could bring to our investors through the vehicles that we were managing. And so sort of that's the backstory to what I do or what I've done over my career. But everything comes down to having a process. It's all about process. And for us, it's about finding ideas and then working on them. A lot of investors will screen for ideas. They'll use numbers searches. We don't do that. I think that's what a lot of other people do. We want to be a little different. How do we do it differently? You don't use numbers. You use keywords. If you screen on breakup, spinoff, restructuring, if you cobble together words like patriarch plus died plus holding company, 15 years ago, you were getting a variety of Asian conglomerates that were transitioning to the next generation. Today, you still get those, but you're also getting German mid-sized industrial businesses where the founder or the second generation, they're older, they want to get out, sell, retire, whatever. Their kids are not interested in the business. They want the money, they don't want the business. So you're seeing breakups and spins and restructurings of those as well. So for us, it's a very tight filter. We want to throw as much as we can into that filter, and out plops very few names on the other end. If too many names are coming out, your filter is not tight enough. And so these keyword searches, 15 years ago doing these searches, you'd get spinoffs of TV shows. The technology just wasn't that good then. Today, you can tighten it up. There's so much advanced ways to do things that we do that. So keyword searches, canvassing our network of bankers to source deals, but also just still talking to these families and individuals that control companies. We're not looking for secrets. We're looking for interesting ideas. And you can build your knowledge base. So I like to be a generalist, and I like everybody on my team to be a generalist. But within that, over time, you become experts at certain verticals. And over the years, for us, it's been shipping, all kinds of shipping, from dry bulk to tankers, which could be product tankers or crude tankers, container ships. There's all kinds of pieces to shipping. It's fish farming. We've invested for over a decade. Today, we own one investment in land-based salmon farming, so they actually grow the fish in tanks. Might sound crazy, but then you have non-GMO and no antibiotics. You can manage everything from the air, the oxygen, the air, the feed. Everything is managed, so you really know what you're getting at the end. You're not at the risks of what's in the ocean. All kinds of renewables we're getting to participate in today. It's really fascinating because if you go to the Nordic countries, what do you find? You find a lot of fossil fuel related, especially in Norway. In the early 70s, they discovered oil and so many in the North Sea, and so many Norwegian companies built businesses related to servicing that, drilling, boats to take you out to the rigs, whatever, all facets of it. Some of these groups became some of the wealthiest families in the world over the years as a result. We're finding that now it's all shifting. They're taking the wealth and the knowledge and the history from the fossil fuel area, and they're evolving into green related and renewables. And they're at the forefront of a lot of what's happening related to this transition to focus on carbon footprint and carbon, you know, actually there's even companies that are in what's called carbon capture. They help, remediate the carbon just as it's coming out of the factory, the ship, the whatever. So there's just a lot of stuff that's bubbling up where you could pay the old fossil fuel valuation, so that's a value stock, but you're getting the tomorrow opportunity, the high growth business. And so let me see what I have on my next slide here. So I'll shift into this, which is, this is to me one of the most interesting things. So I've been investing in Europe now for approximately just about 30 years. And as I said earlier, when I started, it was perhaps one of the best periods of time in the Nordics. Well, now when you expand that to the rest of Europe, I think we are in the greatest period of time for investment opportunities. Now, some people might say, oh, come on. Europe's been a tomorrow story for many, 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 many tomorrows. It's true and it's not true. On the whole, it's been a tomorrow story for a long time. But more specifically, within that, you've had a lot of pockets of time where there have been wonderful opportunities. Now, I'm not saying you should buy Europe. That's not my point here. I'm saying there are companies in Europe. It's back to special situations. And when you think about why Europe, why now, really, perversely, COVID-19 has enhanced the investment opportunity. The U.S. has been on fire, right? We in a positive way in terms of the market after the initial massive sell-off at the beginning of the pandemic. We hit new highs. You've seen this explosion of IPOs, of SPACs, of all kinds of M&A acquisitions. Companies are shedding non-core assets. But new high after new high after new high here for a long period of time. It's just not true when you get outside the U.S. And I think that is actually where we're seeing the most opportunity, because they're further behind in terms of valuation, but they're also further behind in terms of technological improvement, digitalization, focusing on a lot of different areas. And Europe is waking up to the fact that, or they have woken up to the fact that they are behind. And so therefore now their program is to leap forward. And how do they do that? And I'll get to that slide in a couple of minutes, but basically they are launching a stimulus program that they've all voted on already in Europe that is about 2 trillion euros of money that will be coming in for all kinds of things. You'll have more than a couple of hundred billion for a green focus. Well, here in the U.S., green seems to be almost the equivalent of a four-letter word to some people. In Europe, they're taking a different approach. It's let's have a transition period. It could be a decade or longer to shift from certain businesses to more green. You have a digitalization program. Again, hundreds of billions towards modernizing. You have a retrofitting program. So here, when you want to build a new building in New York City, they generally blow up the old one. In Europe, they just kind of keep trying to use the old buildings over and over and over. So you have a lot of cities where you have very old infrastructure and buildings. Some are getting knocked. You go to the UK, they're knocking a lot down. Go to other countries, they really want to take what they have and kind of evolve it. So there's a program for that, because many of those buildings are just not energy efficient on any level. And so what we had coming into the COVID period in Europe was a lot of stars lining up. So as I point out on this slide, you start the day with bigger discounts. Stocks are cheaper there. You have an acceleration of the sale of non-core assets. Companies in Europe have historically, by and large, been what I'll call conglomerate style. They've kind of been in a number of different industries. And now they're going on diets. They're thinning out. They're realizing they don't need to, not only do they not need to be in all these different industries, But at the same time, the market rewards focus. So as the companies, if you think about it, if you have a conglomerate where you have two good growing businesses and one weak business, maybe my quick example is, imagine a company, they have three divisions. The two of them make a dollar each. One plus one is $2. The third one loses a dollar. So you have one plus one is two minus one is one. They're reporting a dollar of earnings. Those two divisions say, hey, let's get rid of that guy. He's a loser, that other division. They push him out. Overnight, their earnings doubled to two. They didn't do anything different, but they got rid of the losing business. They didn't just give it away. They sold it. Maybe they got 40 cents for that. They take that money, they redeploy it in their businesses. All of a sudden, their one plus one equals two becomes, maybe that dollar becomes $1.10 or $1.20 over time. So you're seeing this, and the market will value a conglomerate at its weakest business. So it got valued at that low, that money-losing division or sector or industry. It'll go to your lowest margin business. That goes away, the needle goes to the next best one, and then so on and so on. And we're seeing this happening over and over and over as companies have gems inside, but they're masked by commodity businesses, legacy holdings that are fading out. And those are anchors around the necks of these companies. They shed those businesses. Somebody else buys that. So let's say they're number four in a business. And maybe it's not the worst business. Well, they're a distant number four. Number six buys their number four. That guy becomes number three. He's now a powerhouse. And this company that sold it, they've refocused on their core areas. And it really does play out. We call it deconglomerating. I don't know if it's a real word, but we're calling it that. Because a conglomerate is when they're in all these businesses, well, they're going the other way. And so, as I say, sale of non-core assets, you have shareholder activism in Europe that there's a lot of activists from the U.S. that have gone to Europe, and to cut to the chase, they have not succeeded. Just because you make a change at a company, if you're actually not making a good return there, you're not there to just make change. You're there to make profits, right? And so the fact is we're seeing historically activists were largely unsuccessful because they were trying it American style. What does that mean? That means they go in, think, oh, let's be a bully, punch them in the face, figuratively, and tell them how to run their businesses. The other shareholders might all hate each other in that company, but I can promise you, first they'll circle the wagons, make sure that you get rid of the American guy, and then they'll go back to fighting each other. So what you see is that there's a couple of things that we've seen happen. The activists have started to get smarter. They've realized you could use the system to change the system. You get voted onto the board. Work it from the inside out. You come up with proposals that are to work with the company to achieve better success. And frankly, the pressure has been there from local investors as well on boards and on managements to the level where weaker management teams have been pushed out by and large, not in every case. You're getting a higher caliber of management team coming in. The tolerance for unlimited second chances, as we call it in many of the markets we've been in, it's really gone. And so what we're seeing is that in some cases, the management is the activist. They're their own activists. They're leaders. They're good at what they do. They're creating value. But investors have they're looking backwards, most investors, and saying, well, this company historically didn't make it, and here's why. They're not giving enough credence to the changes at hand. And again, that gives us a window of opportunity to assess these change situations to determine, are we happy with the change? Do we think it will create real bottom line value for shareholders? At the end of the day, you are betting on people. And it's incredible to see what people can do when they're focused on the right area. Incentivize management with equity incentives or super bonuses for achieving hurdles. There's all kinds of things that you can do. So activism is becoming more successful. M&A activity is exploding. Balance sheets are generally strong. across Europe. And so in a low growth environment, companies are buying growth. They're buying out competitors. They're adding on product or services to enhance their offering. They have not used this sort of stressful period of time poorly. They're using it to do deals and to bulk up what they have at much more compelling valuations. So strategic buyers are critically important. At the same time, private equity, KKR, Carlyle, you name them, they have raised record funds for all markets, but especially Europe and Asia. So that money's coming in, bidding up certain businesses or whole industries. The strategic buyers are in there. And so you're getting bidding wars in some cases for companies. It's really quite remarkable what's happening. And then you have good old-fashioned traditional restructuring, meaning operational improvement. You'll have financial restructurings in a low interest rate environment. The reality is companies are not paying nothing in terms of interest. Some companies are still paying reasonably higher rates. They're all trying to refinance at lower and successively lower rates. Look, I'm on the board of I'm not on the board of any companies anymore. I'm on a nomination committee. So just as a quick example, if you go to Sweden, in most companies, when you have you're debating who should be on the board, should the board change, the company will create a subset of the board to make a review. It doesn't work that way in Sweden. In Sweden, they go to the three largest shareholders in the company. Do you wish to comprise our nomination committee? You get to interview the existing board. They don't have any staggered boards or any of that stuff that we have here. You're not looking for non-public information. You're just trying to understand who the players are. Do they make sense to stay? Is the company transitioning into another area? And should we bring on more people that have relevant experience? And you don't have to be an activist, but you can have such an impact through this nomination committee process. And so I'm on the nomination committee for a company, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. It's in the gaming and esports area. And we've made remarkable changes to the board. Remarkable, that I think have been game changers for a gaming business and should affect the outcome over time very positively. So when you add all that together, the slide that I have in front of you is really just to show that I believe that the tailwinds are sort of amplified. So coming out of, we're not out of the COVID-19 environment, but we have a better understanding. There's been more money thrown at this in the compressed period of time, money, brains, technology, science, that we have a vaccine and a series of vaccines in a period of time that's just unprecedented. You could extrapolate that and say, okay, we're probably also in a new era for pharmaceuticals and biotech, where you realize that when companies throw enormous amounts of capital, the governments are lined up to be helpful, and there's sharing of science and technology, you can make a lot of stuff happen. And so just to enhance that, I'll just touch on two quick slides. My mouse died here. Here we go. And this just shows it. The chart on the left shows shareholder activism in Europe has really exploded in terms of the number of campaigns. 2020, of course, was down a little bit because of COVID. This is already old news. It's already picking up again. We're just seeing it really picking up in a more accelerated, I'd say a steeper trajectory than it was before. Private equity, again, 2020, I don't have the full year on here yet. It's hard to get all the data yet. But the fact is, it is record levels or close to it. You'll see 21 probably will dwarf all these others. So this just underpins what I'm talking about, that you have this, really, we think about it as a confluence of these bottom-up, company-by-company opportunities, and then the top-down. What's the top-down? Here we go. So Europe is fine. So the U.S. has had stimulus programs since shortly after the pandemic started. PPP program, all kinds of things for individuals, healthcare related, rent issues, a lot of different programs. Massive intervention from the Fed, you name it, it's all happening here. Some people are positive to it, some people are negative to it. Regardless of how you view it, it's happened and it's continuing to happen. In Europe, predominantly, they've had a bond buying program and virtually no other stimulus till now. So there's the head of the president of the EC, her name is Ursula von der Leyen. She's been there about 18 months. I think she really has made a remarkable difference. Why? She basically realized, in my view, she realized that in every crisis that Europe's ever faced, all their talk of tightening up and pulling it together and being one unified bloc goes right out the window. And every country devolves to, we have to think about ourselves. The only country that really focused on trying to make a cohesive environment was actually Germany through Merkel. So she's wrapping up her final term here. And so von der Leyen basically said, this is our crisis to take advantage, to tighten this thing up. So they forced all the countries together to really bail in, to bail out. And so we're talking about close to 2 trillion euros of stimulus money. I touched on it earlier in the presentation. But the fact is that you can see how much money is coming in. You have various supports to the various countries for them to spend for some of it's for infrastructure, roads, buildings, bridges, whatever, agriculture. You have money to entice private equity to partner with the governments for all kinds of projects related to roads and bridges. So they might be they have things there that they call shadow toll roads. There's no toll, but somebody's counting how many cars go by. And the government pays the private company. So I'm sure the citizens are paying it out of their taxes, but you're not paying it every time you go through like you do here in New Jersey on the turnpike. And then you have all kinds of healthcare programs and preventative for the future pandemics. They're spending a lot of money. And then at the bottom, you can see we have the Next Generation EU program. That's the 750 billion euros that's designed for really the ESG focus, which in Europe, the ESG is really focused on the E piece, the environment. That's the money side. When you make changes that will impact the environment, that's much more capital needed than the social generally or governance, because you're really making significant investments for the long term. And then the digital transitions. We're talking to all kinds of companies that are focused on trying to be involved in this transition to embracing technology aggressively and trying to really leapfrog every other nation. So you have that going on. And so this top down from this, plus the bottom up, what I've talked about earlier, I think this is unprecedented. And that's why I say, I think Europe overall investments will do fine, but I think a curated list of specific special situations should do much better, because you're picking the ones that will really, really take advantage of this. And so how we define special situations, I lay it out here. The good news is I will not read every line to you. It'll sound like I am because I'm going to read the first two, but companies going through strategic change, what we think is a disconnect between the price and the value. It could be all kinds of things. It goes back to what I said earlier about doing the keyword searches, reading the newspaper every day, just online or whatever, and just trying to figure out, is that news interesting enough? Does that mean companies are constantly talking about spinning off assets and so forth? The key is the minute you read it, go to their website. What do they do? How big is that non-core business? What does it mean? We try to understand, is that $3 in value, but it's trading in a $1 stock? You know, what is in there and how will the market value those pieces? And if it's a restructuring, we are fixated on what we call execution risk. How does it happen? Who's doing it? Has it been done before? Is it easy? Are these low bars to step over or are these high bars to step over? because you know we really are focused on understanding all this nuance. If you can buy stocks that are disconnected from the market multiple, they're much lower because there's a problem with it. There's an issue. They stumbled. It's good business. They had a bad quarter. The question is, can they get back on track? If they can, they're so far away. If they just get back to where the market trades, you're going to make a lot of money. What if they do better? And so bad news can be good news. You don't want devastating news, but you want to understand what's the nature of, you know, you're going to make more money in a stock generally, I think, from when somebody thinks it's a sell going up to a hold than from a hold to a buy. Because when somebody thinks something's a sell, they value it so, so low. And so that's it. So as I say here, the various opportunities can be transformations, restructurings, recaps. I've touched on some of these. We look for compounders. Those are companies, the family controlled businesses generally. They've just cranked out phenomenal returns over very extended periods of time. You're tagging along, as we would say, you're riding their coattails. They're doing all the hard work. So I'll press on here to just another page to show you. I call this partnering with great jockeys. You're not buying a horse, you're buying a jockey, right? You need to know that you're betting on, I mean, you need the right assets. That is the horse. The horse doesn't know what to do. You need somebody to lead it, guide it, take it, whatever you have to do to make a horse work. And so those are the CEOs of the company or the main shareholders or the chairman or chairperson. And it's understanding that, you know, sometimes it's a family-controlled group. Sometimes it's a former family-controlled group. I'm going to talk about MTG in a minute. It was once part of a family-controlled group. They broke it up. But the key is to find people who are value creators as opposed to value destroyers. I have met with hundreds of companies in my investment career all over the world. And what I've realized is that you have to meet both kinds. Sometimes you meet, you say, okay, that person that runs that company, look at those decisions. They were not good decisions. They've destroyed value. They think of themselves as value creator. You know that they're a value destroyer. Go meet them. Why? It's like getting the map to the minefield. You're learning how to avoid things. So you want to meet with great investors. And when I say investors, great managers. You also want to meet with the ones that are making weaker decisions. So over my incredibly long history of doing this, we've learned that there's a couple of kinds of managers. There's the ones we call good time Charlies. Good time Charlies are the kinds of CEOs that are the best you can have in good times. They can outsell. They can close deals. They just get it done. It's unbelievable what they can get done in good times. The minute you have a crisis, a pandemic, or whatever, they can't deal with it. They don't know how to make the right decisions. And in fact, they make very poor decisions. So those are good time Charlies, only good in good times. There's other kinds that are what we call the wartime Charlies, right? They're really good in a crisis. They're the best. They make the tough decisions. Many times it's related to headcount, cutting back. You have a sales force of 1,000 people. You're not selling anything because maybe it's concerts. You got to cut it back. So it's being flexible, but making tough decisions. And then you have the ones that are good in both times. And so here on the slide here, I show a couple of companies, and I'll touch on most of these. Not most, it's too many. But so just to touch on MTG for a moment. So MTG, it's a Swedish company. It's called Modern Times Group. MTG was once part of a much larger media conglomerate where they had a broadcasting arm. Then they started making investments in online and mobile gaming and esports. They broke it up about 2 years ago. And where you see, I turn MTG into two companies. So MTG, the one with the red logo, that is the esports and gaming business for the company. So they kept the old name and they put all their newer businesses in that. And they spun off their streaming business where they have 3 million subscribers. I hate to call somebody a mini anything, but I'll call them a mini Netflix. They have 3 million subscribers, mostly in the Nordics and the Baltics. They produce their own TV shows, their own movies as well in the different regions they're in or markets they're in. And then they carry, you know, Fox, Nat Geo, Discovery, Disney, whatever. So they sell packages. So the CEO of Nordic Entertainment Group, I would call him, he's one of those guys who's really, during the pandemic, we went through every stock in our portfolio and said, what are we dealing with? Do we have good time Charlies? Do we have wartime Charlies? Do we have guys who are good? The CEO of this company has been fantastic. Why? Right out of the gate, he recommended to the board, let's cut the dividend. Not because they had to, but because he said, we don't know how bad it's going to get. We have no sports to broadcast in our business, so we're going to cut the price of the packages so that we can not lose any customers, because you don't want customers to think you're charging them full price and giving them less than full service. You don't have shows. How many classics can you show? So he cut the dividend to zero. They were going to sell non-core production studios for TV shows and movies, because a lot of times they're partnering with others to make the shows. They don't need to sell them. They're non-core. He killed off selling the assets during the crisis because they want to get better prices. He went on a massive cost-cutting program. And so he actually really grew the business and the key parts of the business during the pandemic. They actually grew their subscriber base. And so it's just a testament to Anders Jensen, who's the CEO of that company, that you can take the crisis, take advantage of the market, take advantage of the opportunity, and as things dissipate, he set it up so that he could very quickly ramp up. And so that's a top five holding in our portfolio. It's been incredible. And even when they announced operational improvements, they blew away all those numbers. They just continuously found more to do to streamline and refocus the business. They were broadcasting from the UK, where their broadcast center was. They didn't have a business in the UK, but they had their broadcast unit in the UK beaming off the satellites into the Nordics. Well, Brexit was announced. He said, that means taxes go up for us in that market. Boom, they're out of the UK. They moved everything back to Sweden. And so very smart leadership skills, very good decisions on how they operate their business. And they merged with their biggest rival in one of their slices that they're in. Again, it just created a lot of value. So that's a long-term holding for us. We're very happy with it. We own MTG. If any of you guys out there or gals are into esports, they own ESL, which is the largest venue, competitive gaming venue operator. Well, in the pandemic, people, you're not getting 20,000 people into any venue. But the reality is that the company has just been evolving, as other esports companies have as well, to take advantage of the market and sort of the land grab that's still going on in esports. But in the gaming side, they just bought Hutch Gaming in the UK, which is mobile racing. So you're racing on your phone. It's fantastic businesses. So they're buying when every other guy is not sure what, not every other, but many others are not sure what to do. And their business, ESL, has more than 20% market share in esports. So these are compelling businesses. You may not know them because they're not sort of US listed, but the US is for their gaming business at MTG is enormously important to them. Look at Vivendi. So Vivendi, we've owned Vivendi since 2012. Vivendi is a France-based conglomerate for media. A family took control of it, the Bolloré family. So Vincent Bolloré is the sixth generation of his family to run their corporate global empire. They own ports. So Bolloré company, which I didn't list, it is listed under Compounders. So Bolloré is the largest shareholder in Vivendi. Bolloré owns ports throughout Africa. They're one of the largest owners of ports in Africa. They have all kinds of logistics and transportation businesses. They bought control of Vivendi back in 2012. Vivendi's a public company. It has an ADR here, trades in France. Vivendi owns a variety of wonderful assets. But when he got there, it was a mishmash of all kinds of weird stuff. And they started to focus it. It's still a conglomerate. It's a media conglomerate. I'll give you a sense for what they own. They own Universal Music Group, the biggest music company in the world. They used to own 100% of it. Now they own 80. They sold 20% of it to Tencent, the Chinese company. Now, if you look at the value that Tencent paid for that 20%, they bought 10% a year and a half ago. They bought the other 10% just recently for 3 billion euros for each tranche of 10%. So 6 billion euros for the 20%. If you look at that and apply that to just their whole music business, what that would gross up to, you're basically paying for their Universal Music business and you're getting everything else. Who cares, maybe? Well, I care. What's everything else? They own 25% of Telecom Italia, which is the largest phone network, mobile and fixed line phone network in Italy, broadband as well, going through restructuring. They own 30% of Mediaset. That's the largest media conglomerate in Italy as well. It is controlled by Berlusconi's family. He was once the prime minister. That's going through a transformation, pay TV and other broadcasting assets. You have Havas. They own 100% of Havas, the fifth largest advertising group in the world. They have mobile gaming businesses. They have stakes in other companies. They even were part of the venture cap group that helped create Spotify at the beginning. I think they own 3.5% of Spotify within Vivendi. So they have all these little media things. And they just recently announced that before this year's over, they will IPO Universal Music Group. They're going to spin it off to shareholders, but effectively it'll be a listed company. I don't know that they'll raise any cash on that through an actual IPO, but they're going to spin off 60% of Universal Music. That's going to start crystallizing the value at Vivendi. So we love conglomerates where they're peeling these pieces out, as I mentioned before, and you can crystallize the value of the different businesses. So that's a long-term hold. We followed that family into it. I've been talking to Mr. Bolloré for 25 years now. And when I saw him take that stake, we said, okay, now we can look at Vivendi. Before that, it was a perennial tomorrow story. The stock's more than doubled since 2012, just on stock price. It's like, I think it's up about 140%. You add in all the dividends they've paid out since then, because they sold a lot of assets, they paid out dividends. It's more than a triple. I think it's like triple and a half, something like that. And there's more value there, so we continue to own it. I mentioned earlier about companies that are transitioning. I just wonder if I should start shifting into Q&A shortly. And so I'll just mention one or two others quickly, and then I'll open it up for questions. You can ask about this or anything else. Scorpio in the center here. Make a long story short, this is a dry bulk company that just changed its name to Eneti. This shows you how things can radically change. Dry bulk is a commodity business. We were owners here for a long time. We know management well. They are selling every one of their dry bulk ships, and they're purchasing ships that will install wind farms offshore. So that's those are the kinds of ships that cost $250 million per ship plus. So they're going from being a commodity, old style, I'll say almost a polluter in the ocean, to completely green in a transition that's evolving as we speak. Every day they're announcing the sale of their additional old ships. So we love the transition. We think this is a tomorrow story that's becoming a today story. Because first they sell all their ships, then they have a pile of cash, and then the new ships get delivered down the road. They have to be built first. And so the last one I'll mention is in the compounder bucket. It's called IAC. This one is a U.S. company, but I think this is just worthy of explaining just how you can find these wonderful assets. IAC, the full name is IAC Interactive Corp. This is Barry Diller's company. They buy, build, scale up, and then spin off assets to shareholders. 20 years ago, they bought Match.com, and more than 20 years ago. They spun it off in June of 20. At some point, Match was worth more than the whole market cap of the company. So when they announced they were spinning it off, that's when we got involved in IAC. We were getting everything else for free. Dotdash, Vimeo, Care.com. Since then, they bought 12% of MGM. It's incredible. And in their history was doing the same with Expedia, TripAdvisor, Ticketmaster, Today Live Nation. And they've just cranked out enormous returns for shareholders over and over and over and over. And yet we were getting it almost for nothing, because when you backed out Match, which they were spinning off, you got everything for free. Today, they still have a couple of billion of net cash to make new investments. And we just think this is the kind of stock that we will, everything in our compounder bucket, I expect that we will own for years. They're going to spin off Vimeo second quarter of 21 here. So they, in the next few months, that'll crystallize that piece of it. And then there's more where that came from. So perhaps I should shift over to questions here. I didn't realize that I kind of kept blabbing.
No problem there. We can go ahead and jump in here. I'm looking up at the top of our list here of questions that we've had rolling. I guess actually before we jump in here, one of our viewers is asking if we can provide copies of these slides at any given time. If you do want to go ahead and share them, we can make that happen. If not, they can always check back on our video replay as well here.
Yeah, happy to make them available.
For sure. All righty. So up top, looks like our first question here, if not proprietary information, how would you say that you go about determining intrinsic value of a company?
Okay. We look at the business and we try to understand what makes it tick, right? How profitable can it be? So it depends on the nature of the business. If it's an insurance company, you value it a different way than you do a conglomerate that has a variety of businesses. But let's just say it's like an IAC. We look at each piece in their portfolio and you're triangulating. The companies are not always giving you perfect information. But if they have listed companies, we can see where it's trading on the market and we could benchmark, is that a cheap stock or is that an expensive stock? So if it's a holding company with listed assets, we say, is it cheap on cheap assets or cheap on expensive? Meaning, are the things they own high multiple or are they low multiple? So you're getting a double discount. For something like an MTG, Frank, or let's say Vivendi, we understood from the beginning we were getting Universal Music. They gave enough information you could understand the potential growth and the huge growth of so anybody who ever downloads a song is paying Vivendi because Universal Music has Taylor Swift and a whole bunch of a piece of the Stones catalog and a piece of Frank Sinatra. They have this incredible 100-year catalog of different assets and stars. So we could say, okay, we would model out cash flows. We don't like to do DCS, discounted cash flow analysis. I find that for most businesses that just you could self-fulfill whatever you want that to be worth. We want to look at what is it worth based on what they've done over the last few years, and we apply a modest amount of potential growth going forward, and then we just add up all the different divisions. Music businesses trade at this. Their gaming business at that. And so we just add them all up. Then we net any debt against it. And then we, and along the way, we're taking haircuts. We say, well, their gaming business might not be good as good as the next guy, so let's take a discount. And so you gross that up and you come up with an intrinsic value for that. And then that value is not fixed in stone for the rest of your life because those businesses are live businesses. So they might do better or worse than you think. And you have to tweak it along the way. But if you think that it's worth 45 euros per share plus as they continue to do things and you're buying it at 20, we say, okay, it's trading at a huge discount. They're working every day for themselves, but they're letting us tag along with them. So we know our intrinsic value is a certain level with all the haircuts along the way and so forth. And so we do that and we work our way back from there. We try to build a conservative model because if it's cheap on a conservative model, the market isn't always conservative. When the market gets carried away, you're going to do really well. But the key is to get in with conservative perspective and take advantage of it and look at comps. So Bolloré owns ports. Well, where do ports trade at? And I don't just mean in the stock market. Have ports been bought or sold by companies in private market transactions? We track those, and then we can apply those kinds of multiples. So we're reading trade regs and all kinds of articles in different markets. We really, that keyword alerts that we talked about earlier, it's not just for new ideas. It's to do maintenance analysis on our existing portfolio as well.
Understood. It looks like we have a little bit of one of those Bloomberg windows kind of creeping in on us here. We can go ahead and just back out of the screen share here, and that should solve all the problems for us.
Oh, well, okay. That's what we call a rookie move. Sorry about that. Okay.
No problem. All righty, there we go. Moving on to our next question here. Do you do any segment analysis, like the GE analysis in 2000 by Michael Price?
We do. We really do. We really break out all the pieces. We're trying to understand, you know, what's the heartbeat of this company? Where do they make money? Where do they lose money? And kind of mash that all together and figure out, you know, is there real value buried in here? And also you want to avoid unintended exposures or risks. So you really have to understand the segments, how they've managed them relative to others. I mean, look, I said it before, working for Michael Price was one of the greatest experiences for me. Not easy, tough, but fair. But I learned exactly that. And the lesson from him was dig, get more information. Oh, you dug? Great, dig more. That was before the internet. I mean, you just had to keep going through the footnotes to find out. And what you learned from him was always look for, you know, are there any, what's in the other liabilities category? What could be skeletons in the closet? But you also learn what's in the other assets category. Do they have stakes in public companies that are valued at cost? They don't pay dividends, those companies. So it's kind of just lost in the shuffle. And meanwhile, it could be worth tons of money. So yes, segment analysis is critical. Depends on the nature of the business. We're not going to do a sum of the parts analysis if we don't think the business is going to break up. GE obviously is breaking itself up and has been. And so doing that kind of work is critically important. And then you kind of work up your model from there.
Understood. And moving down our list here, do you think any peripheral countries to some of the region we've been looking at here, for example, Portugal, Spain, Italy, Greece, obviously we've hit on Italy here, will offer some of these best opportunities? Looks like an example provided here. Spain has had a lot of global leaders, which stocks seem currently depressed.
So Spain really has had quite a few tough years over just in terms of just economic conditions, variety, and Italy as well. Yeah, I mean, as I said at the beginning, you want to go to these kinds of markets where they've had a tough run because there are wonderful companies in Spain and in Italy. Italy is just chock full of little conglomerates that are transitioning as well. And so those markets, we've had investments in Portugal. You know, before the pandemic, we were traveling everywhere. We're doing it all like this now through Zoom or something like it. It's second best. It's not as good as being in the room with people, but the fact is we've spent a lot of time in Portugal. We've spent a lot of time in Spain. We've spent a lot of time in Italy. In fact, we go to these markets more than the UK. We have one position in the UK. That's the first stock that we bought in 6 years in the UK. Why? I didn't know Brexit was coming years ago. It's just that most US-based investors start in London. Similar language, not same. And push up the valuations over time. Post-Brexit, there's opportunities. We did one trip just before the pandemic to London. We said, okay, now it's time to look here. We'll get back there, and we're doing a lot of work there. But we always focused on the peripheral markets. That's, in fact, how did Mr. Bolloré in this compounder bucket really create an enormous additional leg to his wealth? It's exactly this. He went to Italy. He went to Spain. He went to other markets. He went really peripheral. He went to Africa. And he really just found high-quality assets at peripheral market valuations and then squeezed value out of them. So learn from these masters. I mean, the fact is those markets offer a lot of opportunity and generally at a more compelling valuation. You just have to layer in, is there more risk? Are they more of a domestic play than an international? We like international plays. They happen to be based somewhere, but they're based in Madrid, but they have a global business. They're based in Milan, they have a global business, or Rome, or wherever.
Definitely. And continuing on, any thoughts on semiconductor businesses? And we'll go ahead and lump Intel in here as well.
Well, look, Intel's going through a massive change, right? A transition. So you have a couple of things going on. You have this chip shortage that is being talked about every which way. At the same time, and Intel just changed management. So Intel somehow fell from the perch to being, let's just say, off the perch. And that's when you want to look at these. You know, you, again, bad news from once great businesses, you have to make a judgment call. Can they get back there? People love AMD today. Now, I remember visiting them a long time ago. They were the perennial tomorrow story, perennially. Oh, they finally became a today story, and they made up for all the years that they were the tomorrow story. So when great businesses stumble, that's a newsflash for you to say, I have to focus on this. You generally don't have to just run out and buy it. You get time. Read about it. Who's the new management at Intel? What's their history? What's their backstory? What's their track record? Does it look like filler, like somebody who is okay? Or do they bring in an A-quality person? I don't know the specific case that well. I've taken just a cursory look. But the fact is, it's those kinds of things that attract us when there's change at hand, because you can find so much value. You know, this company in our portfolio, Exor, so that's the Agnelli family's holding company from Italy. That's Chrysler, Fiat, Ferrari, Maserati. They also have an insurance business. When did they buy Chrysler? During the financial crisis from the U.S. government that had bailed it out. They paid a couple of billion. Today, Jeep is the cornerstone of their cash flow. And they just merged Fiat Chrysler with Peugeot in France, creating something called Stellantis. So they control all of this. It's the fifth largest car company in the world. So I can own this. And John Elkann, who's the head of the family, is working for us every day, because he's not working for us. He's working for himself and his family, but we get to tag along. So yes, finding those compounders, finding those peripheral markets, and people who are good at saying, that group had a crisis, can I take advantage of it? Like Bolloré does, like Exor does. IAC does it when they took their stake in MGM. There's a lot of that out there, and you want to track those people. We track those people and those companies especially.
For sure. And moving down, we'll go ahead and call this second to last question here for us. Looks like we got a question in our audience regarding Atlantic Sapphire. And it seems like they've been having negative cash flow and negative net margin. How do you go about valuing that business?
So Atlantic Sapphire, I mentioned earlier, that's the land-based salmon farming company. They're a Norwegian business that has operations in Denmark and actually Florida. So basically what we've invested in fish farms for many years. What we did here was we said, well, their Danish business had 3,500 tons of capacity. The U.S. at full capacity will be over 200,000 tons of capacity. This was really an aberration for us. This is a company that we have to model it out, because they are disrupting the whole chain here in the U.S. for salmon. We are a net importer. This company is based in the U.S., and their view is you won't have to fly fish in from Scotland or Norway or whatever. We're going to just have it in Florida. We could chill it and truck it or fly to you from Florida. The key is, you're right, you're not generating profits yet. The first harvests were only in September for the U.S. because, frankly, it takes 23 months from egg to plate in a salmon. And so what we do is we construct a model and we say, okay, what is it going to take for these guys to be profitable? How much capacity do they have to have built out? And how much risk is there to it? I would say at some point they were a little bit behind track. They're way on track right now. They've announced recently they're accelerating the move to phase two. So the first 10,000 tons of capacity has opened. They're using every nickel that comes out of that to accelerate the second phase. We want them to keep reinvesting in the business, but we value it by looking at the totality of what kind of cash flow can be generated over the next couple of years. So we look at a couple of years, and when we first bought, I mean, the stock's up a lot since we bought it. Maybe it was 40 when we bought it. It's 140 today. We think it's still grossly undervalued. Why? Because when you model out the potential for cash flow generation here, it really does dwarf the enterprise value today. But you do have to look forward. So if I'm a Michael Price guy, I only kind of want to look backwards and look at what we have today, maybe a little bit into the future. Well, and when we first started in this one at 40, the market was basically factoring in over, in our view, over a 90 percent risk of this thing just not working. But because of our knowledge and work and homework that we did in the fish area, we realized, no, the market's over penalizing it. And when the cash spigot kicks on, I think investors are going to see that the company really is a cash machine. And they are now sold in every Wegmans and all kinds of other stores in the United States. But that only started in September. So you ramp up right now with each successive harvest. Now you have higher and higher yields of supply of fish. And they're actually getting a premium. At the last investor presentation, they said their average premium was over 140% more than the commodity salmon price. People love the fish because it's as I said before, non-GMO. It's a clean fish where everything's managed well. But it is about constructing a model and looking out a little bit further. And the key to the question, I guess, from your person who asked the question, is do we have the financial wherewithal to get there? So that was the other thing. They raised a lot of money. We participated in their second round at the beginning. And then along the way, they've done some additional offerings to have a bulletproof cash hoard to get through to the next phases, and we're very happy with it. There are other land-based salmon farms. They are subscale in terms of their balance sheet. They may not have enough money to get there. And when those bad headlines come out, it will impact a lot of the land-based guys, but the reality is Atlantic Sapphire is one of the best positioned. And I think if you spend a little more time, and I'd be happy to talk to you if you'd like to go further at some point, just reach out. But yeah, this is one that we like a lot. If you look at our filings, we reduced it a little bit. It just became too big in the portfolio. We do look at position sizes overall. It's critical to manage the portfolio. Also, not just from the 1 foot view, but from the 1,000 foot view, and look at your exposures and balance things out as a portfolio manager.
Definitely. And to go ahead and round us out here, looks like we have a viewer who says, being a Dane with shipping experience, they're wondering if you have any thoughts on DS Norden and DFOS and any valuation or any thoughts on them there.
You know, I just don't know those specifically well enough. I mean, obviously I know Maersk, one of the largest players in the world. But the ones that you're mentioning, I just don't have enough depth here. I will say that we do have a shipping guru internally in our firm. And so I'd be happy if that person wants to reach out to us, we'd be happy to chat with them about it. But I don't want to take a stab at it. I'd prefer to just have maybe a separate conversation on it.
For sure. Well, David, that'll round things out for the majority of our questions here today. Thank you so much from us here at Guru Focus and for the audience out there for taking the time to give such a great presentation and dive into these questions here. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on here.
Graham, thank you so much. I really have enjoyed it. And as I said before, we're happy to make the slides available. And if anybody has any follow-up questions, just we're happy to chat anytime.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on gurufocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of Guru Focus where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.